Thank you. So good afternoon. We are looking at the Holocaust through the lens, through the eyes of a very special individual today. And we're going to see how this particular person experienced and saw the Holocaust through his own writing, his own letter. So to do that, we need to take a step back and give some context. You have three pieces of paper in front of you. You have a bibliography, then you have two double-sided sheets, which we will get to. The bibliography on the front is just a snapshot of sources that you can follow up on, because we're going to give just a brief overview today of this much, much bigger picture. You see in the first section of references are three published items. The first is a book, which is very difficult to get a hold of, called Gates of Tears, The Holocaust in the Lublin District, which was published a little under 10 years ago by Professor David Zilber Klang from Yad Vashem. We'll reference him a little bit later. An article that was presented about 15 years ago at the Washington Holocaust Museum, you can get online, called The Theological Letters of Rabbi Talmud of Lublin by Gershon Greenberg, and then Professor Zilber Klang's article online. These relate to the narrow letter we're going to address in a few minutes. If you zoom out for a second, we're talking about Lublin. So you have here the Warsaw, the Jewish Museum. They have a section on the Chachmei Lublin, which you can look up. There is an entry on Rav Meir Shapira, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chachmei Lublin Yeshiva, which we'll talk about on Yivo. There are books about him. And then there's this book, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And then this book, I put it on the sheet because it's going to be important to think about it as a theological frame. So this is just your for further reading discussion of what we're going to address today. And maybe the theme or the thesis of today is that life is complicated, and that emuna, our relationship with God, is complicated, and that great people struggle with life and with emuna. Not just us regular people, but even great people struggle at times with emuna. So the focal point of our discussion is going to be a letter, the second of two letters. This letter is authored in the fall of 1942 in Lublin. Not yet. We'll get to it. Lublin, which of course, as you know, is a city in Poland, was for many generations an important community, an important center of Jewish life in Eastern Europe. There was a yeshiva there in the 16th century, and then moving into the 17th and 18th centuries, Lublin was the seat of what was known as the Vad Arba Aratzos, which means the Council of the Four Lands. There was a huge swath that was under this essentially autonomous or largely autonomous Jewish body that was led and run by a group of rabbinic luminaries in Lublin. So Lublin was, at this time, which is the heyday of Eastern European Jews, it was like the center, so to speak, until it was disbanded in 1764. Some of the great, both Talmudic commentaries and halachis and Hasidic masters, like the Chozo of Lublin, were from this well-known town. So Lublin, you're talking about a Jewish community that is well-established, a very important center. That's just the biggest background. Then we hone in to the person who's writing this letter to understand the personal background, the milieu in which he was raised, and what it meant to be in his shoes, if we could somehow not really imagine what that meant like, but in some sense. And to do that, we're going to meet our author today, And his name was Reb Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. Talmud was his last name. He was born in 1912. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting last name. Yes. So in Yiddish, that's okay. In Yiddish, they would call someone Tzvi Elimelech, which was not an uncommon name in Eastern Europe. They would call him probably Hirsch Melech, which is probably what his family called him. And Rav Hirsch Melech Talmud, he went to study in the Lubliner Yeshiva. He was born in a small town called Glogov Malopolsky, of course, I'm mispronouncing that. And he went to study as a young man. He was born in 1912. He goes as a teenager to study in the yeshiva called the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. Now, this is a very important institution, which we need to know a little bit about to put it in the context of what this man was about in terms of who he was and where he was reared. For several generations already, we've talked about the Volozhin Yeshiva and other yeshivas in a Lithuanian tradition, primarily in Lithuania or northern Poland in that area. So that already existed in the 19th century. However, if you went to study in Volozhin, obviously you were a great, you know, great young scholar, but you also had a lot of things that went on studying in Volozhin or other yeshivas, where you had to sleep in someone's house, or you had to be sponsored. There was a kest program where you had someone give you meals, and it was not what we think of when we think of a yeshiva today, right? You talked about how your grandson is going to study in a yeshiva in Israel. He doesn't stand, no one sets him up on a street corner that he should eat, you know, in someone's house. But came along a man, a young man who was a remarkable visionary. His name was Rav Meir Shapira. Rav Meir Shapira himself was from Galicia. He was a Hasidic Yid. His parents were very prominent. He came from a prominent Hasidic family. And he came up with the idea that he was going to create a yeshiva in Lublin, meaning a Polish yeshiva, which was going to be in the spirit or have the environment of his upbringing of Hasidus, but with the scholarly bent of a traditional Lithuanian yeshiva. But not only was it going to be a great yeshiva in the middle of Poland in Lublin, it was going to be a new type of yeshiva, where the yeshiva would be a full experience, where instead of having to worry about local donors who were going to take care of boys, they were going to have a yeshiva building in which everything was going to be provided for the students, which is actually the model for the yeshivas that we have today. In Volozhin, they didn't have a mikveh in the yeshiva building, and they didn't have a cafeteria, and they didn't have a dormitory. They had a yeshiva base medrash building. But Rav Meir Shapira had this vision, this dream of a full-service yeshiva, we could call it. So he went around with this idea, and in 1922, he goes to meet a wealthy balabas, a family, a couple. The man's name was Shmuel Eichenbaum, who volunteered to donate a parcel of land on the corner of two streets, Unika and Lubartovsky streets. Now, I've never been to this place, but I can tell you Maury was sad that he's not here today, so he sent me pictures last night, pictures from his trip to Lublin, of what the Lublin yeshiva looks like right now. And they set up a fundraising committee in 1923. They fundraised from people around the world, not just locally in Poland, but from all around the world. And on Lag BaOmer, on May 22nd, 1924, thousands of people arrived for the laying of the cornerstone. And ultimately, they opened the yeshiva on the 24th of June, 1930. Rav Meir Shapira was then established as the Rav of Lublin, although a few years later, he was going to head elsewhere for a formal appointment, and he's going to last in Lublin just for a short time. The yeshiva building, it was a five-story modern building. It had central heating. These things, we take them for granted today, but at that time, first of all, the fundraising task, one of the students describes, and we're going to get to this book a little bit, describes the amount of money that he needed to raise. You're talking about tens of thousands of dollars in the 1920s, but how he felt like this was his personal crusade. Reb Meir Shapira never had any children, so he said that the yeshiva was his child. He took upon himself the responsibility to steward this yeshiva. They had dormitory rooms for students. They had a garden in the front. They had a well-known library. There's a big mystery of what happened to the library of the Chachmei Lublin Yeshiva after the Nazis came in, because some of the books were probably burned, but it sounds like scholars seem to indicate that most of the books were not destroyed. They had a massive library, and probably during the fog of war, they were scattered in different places. Dr. Lyman, he has a few books from Chachmei Lublin, but the yeshiva had an apartment for the Rosh Yeshiva. It had a shul, it had a Beis Medrash, and it also had, interestingly, if you go on the YIVO page, they had a model of the Beis HaMikdash, which was the only one in Eastern Europe. Now, I don't know why Reb Meir Shapira thought that that was an interesting thing to do, but it became a place where people would come and visit. They would check it out, because no one ever had seen such a thing. He was obviously a brilliant, visionary thinker. Some of you may have heard of Reb Meir Shapira because of the well-known Jewish phenomenon called Daf Yomi, daily page of study. He was the one who is credited with founding the Daf Yomi. There may be somebody else who was involved, but primarily we associate the Daf Yomi with Reb Meir Shapira being introduced at the Aguda convention, the Knesia Gedola. He later became the head of the Aguda in Poland. Unfortunately, Reb Meir Shapira died, I believe it was, of typhus in October 27, 1933, which he had just taken a position elsewhere. He was still in charge of the yeshiva, but he took a position in a local city, I think even a couple of weeks before that, and he died very suddenly. He had no children, and he did not live to see. They had a special certificate program for the boys who finished matriculating in the yeshiva. I think it was a few weeks later, a few months later. So he died before he got to see the fruits of his labor. But nonetheless, the yeshiva was a premier Torah institution. They had between 200 and 300 boys at a given time, and to be welcomed into the yeshiva, so you had to know 200 blot of Gemara cold. 200 pages, just like that. You couldn't just, not anybody was welcome in the yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. And then unfortunately, the Nazis occupied it in 1939, and they turned it into a headquarters, and afterwards, I think it was after the war, for a period of time, it was a hotel and all kinds of things. But I believe that now, the yeshiva, the Jewish community owns the building, and in March is going to be the siyum for the Seder Moed, the first section of Talmud, of the orders of the Talmud. So I believe someone told me that they had tickets to go to Lublin because they're making a siyum in the yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. And I met multiple people. I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but this is it's a destination, and now it's a Jewish place. For a while, it did not belong to Jews. It was...
So part of it is actually a museum.
Museum.
I was there with my daughter and her school, and we, in memory of Rabbi
Shira,
we did the Gemara there, and
we
were able to make a siyum.
There you go. Right, so this is like the end of that story, the postscript. Okay, when the war breaks out, many of the boys in Chachmei Lublin, many of them went to Vilna. We've talked about this before, how Reb Chaim Ozer Grzesinski was taking care of them. One of the boys, one of the survivors of the Chachmei Lublin yeshiva, was a brilliant Talmudic giant who lived in Montreal. His name was Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung. This is his book. It's called The Veil of Tears. It's a beautiful memoir. It was actually fascinating. This was originally published in Yiddish in 1944. How was it published in 1944? Because, as is described in this volume, he went from Lublin to Vilna. He met Reb Chaim Ozer Grzesinski. He was with a group from the Chachmei Lublin Yeshiva. He and a few others from Chachmei Lublin were able to get the last visas from Sugihara. So he went from Lublin to Vilna, from Vilna to Japan, from Japan to Shanghai, and then from Shanghai he came to San Francisco, and from San Francisco, they sent him to Montreal. So this is his story of the first couple of years of the war. It's not so much about Chachmei Lublin, but he describes in here how when he met Reb Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, how Reb Chaim Ozer was talking about Reb Meir Shapira and what an unbelievable person he was. That Reb Meir Shapira was a phenom. He was, you know, singular. So the...
What was the word
you used? Phenom? He was an unusual person. He was like a visionary. He was once, right, incredible. Most of the Chachmei Lublin students were murdered, but there were a few who were able to escape. So Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung is one of them, and there were a few others. But this was a major rabbinic institution. At the end of that period, when the Nazis arrived, the Rosh Yeshiva was a man by the name of, I think his name was Rav Shimon Eger, and there was another Rosh Yeshiva there who, if you go to visit YU, if you ever have a chance, they have a beautiful library. On the fifth floor of the library, when you walk out the door of the elevator, there's a big, magnificent picture of a, looks like a rabbi, with a tall yarmulke, with a hadras panim, a beautiful beard. And underneath it, it says, I'm trying to remember if it says his title, but it says Rabbi Arye Leib Fromer. This floor of the library was dedicated to the memory of Rabbi Arye Leib Fromer, who was one of the last leaders of the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin.
Fromer.
Fromer. I'm going to take this off. It's not working. We're 6 feet. Fromer. He was a Rav in a city called Kozhaglov. So he was known as the Kozhaglov or Rav, and he wrote a series of responsa, questions and answers, called Shilas and Tshuvas Questions, Eretz Tzvi. Eretz Tzvi. That's the... Now, the Kozhaglov or Rav was very similar to Rav Meir Shapira in that he came from a Hasidic upbringing. So many of the topics that he writes about are things that Jewish people were dealing with if you came from a Hasidic upbringing. So I'll give you an example. Let's say Pesach night, what do you use for maror? Well, in many Hasidic communities, they used the horseradish, not romaine lettuce, especially in Hasidic communities, and today also many people use that. So the question is, well, how much do you have to eat? Well, most of us today probably use romaine lettuce, but Hasidim have that. Many of them have that meaning. Like when I was growing up, my father still used the hard stuff. That's what we used to call it. So the Kozhaglov Rav has a tshuva about this. How much? Because a lot of his tshuvas are about that milieu. This was different than if you were in Vilna. You were in Lublin. You were in an area that was highly Hasidic, and at the same time, with this great emphasis on scholarship. So it was a really unique type of place, the Chachmei Lublin Yeshiva. Okay. So now, who is studying in the Yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin? This young man, Reb Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. And he receives rabbinic ordination, and he remains in Lublin. He remains in Lublin, and at the outbreak of the war, he is one of five rabbis who are functioning as the rabbinic leadership of the community, of the Jewish community in Lublin. Very interesting that he was responsible for overseeing an issue of a marriage and divorce cases. That was one of his responsibilities. And I believe he was actually the last remaining one, because the Lublin, first the ghetto was decimated by a series of deportations. Then they were moved to a smaller ghetto. I forget the name of the smaller ghetto in Lublin that they were moved to. It was called Majdan Tatarsky. That was a small ghetto. He was a dayan. He officiated at this is a whole other story, but it kind of shows some of the complexity of what he was dealing with. Because he was also a member of the Judenrat, he had to deal with various, you know, tricky cases. So there was a guy whose name was, what was his name? Grager or Grier, Shammai Grier. This was, if you read about the story in Lublin, this was a very controversial episode, because shortly after the major deportations of 1942, this guy, Shammai Grier, who was married to someone else, decided he wanted to marry some 17-year-old girl who he met. So then he had a connection to one of the Nazi officials by the name of Dr. Harry Sturm, who was like the vice principal of the ghetto at that time. And so they got Rabbi Talmud involved to be able to work on a divorce. And then they had a wedding where His friend, Dr. Stern, was kind enough to send beautiful roses from the Gestapo. Just the postscript of this is that on November 9th, 1942, shortly thereafter, this couple, Greyer and his wife, they were personally executed by Stern. So just, you know, the Nazis were geniuses at deception because they were trying to, it's like, it's a wild story. But who was the rabbi who was officiating at this controversial wedding? It was Reb Hirsch Melech Talmud, because he was essentially the last man standing. So in the middle of all of this, after all of the deportations over the course of the summer of 1942, and the being transferred to this smaller ghetto, Reb Hirsch Melech Talmud is now really all alone. He had a family, he had a wife, and he had one son, who we'll see in a minute, he adored and admired incredibly. But meanwhile, he stayed in Lublin. He was the rabbinic personality of Lublin. So he's looking at everything through the eyes of not just a student, but now a rabbi, a community leader, a member of the Judenrat, and seeing everything disappear. So what I'd like to do is to read with you the letter that he sent to his friend. He had a colleague, a friend, from his days in the yeshiva of Chachma Lublin, who was elsewhere. It doesn't say in the letter where he was. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was in Warsaw. His friend's name was Rab Aryeh Berglas, Rab Chaim Aryeh Berglas. If you see, it's on the third page of your document. Maybe before we do that, I'll just share with you this. I didn't know if it was necessary to make a Xerox, but when Rav Meir Shapiro was running around the world fundraising for the yeshiva, he did an interview in 1924 with the Jewish Chronicle in London, which is fascinating. Rabbi Deputy M. Shapira, he describes how there was a great gathering and there it's a 62,000 square yards and how much it was going to cost. This is a real fundraising project. Let's get back here. This I didn't put in the packet. Let's get back here to Rav Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. Okay, you know what? Maybe before we do the letter, I'll just do this one piece also. If you see this dark-colored page, I'm indebted. We once talked about calendars and time in the Holocaust and Professor Rosen. So in his book, he tipped me off to find this, which is that Rav Elimelech Talmud made a calendar. What you are looking at is the handwriting. You see on the page, Archium Panstuowo Wilublini. Well, you can go online, which is what I did to find this. I was able to get, thanks to Professor Rosen's footnote, he gives you the website. Thank God there's a translation thing on the button. You go from Polish to English, because otherwise I would be calling you. Because my Polish, you know, is... So I actually was able... This I was able to get, and I can email it to you. I was able to find the website and navigate to the page where they have the Polish State Archives from Lublin. And in there, they have the full handwritten calendar that Reb Tzvi Elimelech Talmud created for the Jewish community. And you see when it is. Lishnas Tufshin Gimel, meaning 1942 to 1943. You see who signs it? Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. Mesura Aydea Rav Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. And then if you turn the page, you could see it says, Tishrei, when is the Molad? When is the new moon? What day of the week? When is Tzom Gedalia? What is the Shabbos laning? What time is candlelighting on the right side? Can you see it? 6:47, 6:32, 6:15, 6 o'clock. This is his own handwriting. So even though he saw so much destruction, he was still preparing a calendar. This is going to take them into 1943. Right? Amazing. This is actually his own handwriting. They had a functional Jewish community even during this time. They were performing weddings. They had a functioning, some semblance of a community. Yeah, that's correct. It's interesting. He had a colleague. It sounds like one of the articles, it sounds like he had a colleague, a Nazi who was, his name was Roland, Dr. Roland von Seeberg Everfelt. just in case you want to drop that name of somebody. He was the German archivist for the Lublin District Civilian Government of the Germans. And he packed up the Lublin Judenrat archive in 1944, including Reb Hirsch Melech's documents, which is probably how it survived, and transferred it to Krakow, because it's likely that he was interested in writing a book about Jews. And there, you know, the Germans were going to make a museum about Jews. So it's very likely that Reb Hirsch Melech Talmud, was in contact with him. It's probably him, but maybe somebody else who was responsible for keeping tabs on what the Jews were doing so that they were interested, so they could keep track of it. How crazy is that? That they were going to make... So you are looking at an actual Xerox copy of this calendar, which is incredible, that this is what he was preparing. Now, the... No, so that's what I was going to say. The end of the story is that 1,000 Jews, most of the Jews were murdered by the time this letter is going to be written in October. On October 22nd, 1,000 Jews were murdered, and then that little ghetto that he was in, the Majdan, what's it called, Tartarsky ghetto, that was liquidated on November 9th. So some were sent in 1942. Some of those people were shot immediately, and some of them were sent to Majdanek. And it's likely that in 1943, Rabbi Talmud was killed in Majdanek. May of 1943. So it sounds like he survived for about 5 months. We don't have I don't know the exact date of when he was killed in Majdanek, but he was taken from Lublin to Majdanek in November, and then it sounds like from the testimony he was killed sometime in May. So he did not see the rest of the year, and the community, there was nothing left. Lublin was totally destroyed. All the Jews were removed from the ghetto. It was liquidated. So now we come to the letter. So what I did was, this letter, there was no... And I'm aware of. There is no English translation of this letter, but you are looking at the original. So what I did for you was I put numbers on the side so we can read along together. You can follow in the numbers. And I also put in the margin, you see, notes on what the theme of each section of the letter is, so that we could follow it, and you'll know what he's talking about. You ready?
The underlining, is that the theme?
So I'm going to go back to the underlines just to make it easier for us to follow.
Is it written in Hebrew?
Yes, this is a Hebrew letter. It starts Beis Hei, with the help of God. Shalom Rav, I'm on line number one. To you, Yedidi Hayakar, my beloved friend, Tzamud Levavi, close to my heart, Rab Chaim Aryeh Berglas. You see on the top left, that is the recipient of his letter. He says, Rev Talmud writes, he says, I have to thank you so much for your letter, because Rabbi Berglas sent him a letter. I'm not aware that these letters are extant, although in one of the footnotes somebody says, if you find this letter in archive somewhere, please publish it, because we only have one direction. This is the second of the two letters. The first one was sent earlier in the summer. This is written in the fall, in October, after the Yom Tovim, to Rabbi Berglas. He says, I got your letter, and I thank you so much. However, I have to apologize for getting back to you late. Why? He says, and this is the introduction to the letter. He says, I'm so sorry I was running late, because, and think about the context here, he said, I couldn't write back to you because it was just what? When did we say this letter was written?
October.
In October. So what's going to be? That's right. The holidays. And he says, he doesn't say why, but you can imagine why. He says, I was very busy because this was the first time I had to serve as the chazan for Yom Noraim, for the high holidays. So he says, I had to learn the liturgy, which I never did before. Why does he have to learn the liturgy? Why does he have to serve as the chazan? That's it. He's the last man standing. So this is October 1924. So he says, I couldn't answer you because I had to learn how to daven for the Amud, which is not that's not surprising that somebody was a rabbi and they learned in Chachmei Lublin, but he wasn't a chazan. He wasn't a trained chazan. So he says, I had to be on line number five. Hiskanti me'odi arayom az lios shliach tzibur lefnei kahal. I had to be the chazan on Yom Noraim. And therefore, because of that and a lot of other issues, I couldn't write back to you. So let's start the letter now on line 10. Yes, sure. Yes.
If you have time after this.
So line 10. He says, I'm just going to ask you not to judge me in this letter and just tell me what's going on. I want to know, Mikol Hanishma Etzlecha, in line number 10, what's happening with you? B'yichud, specifically, u'bechlal manishma etzlechem b'svivaschem. What's going on around you? What's happening in the neighborhood? I want to know all the things that are going on in your life. The first thing I'll tell you, it says on line 13, I'll tell you what's going on here. You ask me what's doing, here we are. V'rishon t'chila maher levasercha. I have to tell you what's happening. At la'achar dumia mimushcha. After some quiet, meaning I haven't heard from him in a long time, I received Kibalti Biyom Shmini Atzeres Michtav. I got a letter, Mi Admor Mi Biyan Shlita. There was a rabbinic personality, a Hasidic master, the Biyan Rebbe. And he says, I used to be in touch with him in the summertime. We went back and forth. Then I didn't hear from him in a while, and I wasn't sure what happened. Hodativ, I told him in the summertime all the things that were going on over here. Sha'avru Aleinu line 15, Valkol Ore Hamachos, and all the neighboring towns. And you see where it is in the underline. Lohe Elamti, I did not hide from him. Af Ofane Shiluach La'azazel. What you see in this letter is Rabbi Talmud, because he's writing to a rabbinic Talmud colleague, using rabbinic terms to explain something. It's not a code, but it's a term. What is something which is sent la'azazel? Where does that phrase appear in biblical literature? Where does it appear in the Chumash? Yes! Where is it going? What's happening to it in the wilderness, says the Gemara? That's right. It's being pushed off a cliff to its death. So what is he saying here in this not-so-oblique reference? He says, I told him about people who are being sent la'azazel, which means that already in October of 1942, in the Lubliner ghetto, they were well aware that the people who were being deported, what was happening to them? They were being murdered. They knew this. And that's why in the next underline, you see where it says, they're sent to l'makom shekol boyin lo yishuvun. You see the second underline? Wherever they go, they don't return. So he says, I told the Bayana Rebbe that this is what's happening. We know it's what's happening. They're sending the people away. Now he puts in a parenthetical. I have to share this parenthetical because it just shows you the humanity, the greatness of people. He says in the parenthetical, which if you want to give a story on spiritual resistance and spiritual heroism, he puts a little parenthesis on line 17. Derech Agav, I have to tell you the greatness of this great tzaddik. Because you should know that the way that it was in most Hasidic courts is that when people would come and visit the Rebbe, they would bring a pidyon, they would bring a contribution, a donation. But he said that the Boyana Rebbe, he was very careful. He didn't want to take money from just anybody because he wasn't sure how they earned that money and what the story with that was. So he was very particular about who he took money from. So he was very poor, and you can imagine in this circumstance how impoverished he must have been. So Reb Hirsch Melech says, I sent some money to the Boyana Rebbe, and he sent back to me, he said, look, you should know, I don't really know where this money that you sent me came from. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure, because there are a lot of people who are in need now, I'm going to make sure to give it to all those people. So don't worry, Rabbi Talmud, your money is going to go to good use. There are lots of poor people who I'm going to give it to. So Rabbi Talmud is writing to his friend, Rabbi Berglass. He says, you see the greatness of this man who's living in such an impoverished and difficult state. And what does he say? He says, I want to be careful not to take any money for myself that I don't know is 100% where it came from. So I'm going to make sure to give it to the poor. What do you mean give it to the poor? You're the poor. No, there are always people who are more poor than I am. So he says, that's how great he was. And look at the underline, the long underline here in line number 23. This is the key to spiritual resistance. Shelon lishtanu orchas chayeim hapnimiyim. They did not change their way of life, hapnimiyim, their inner way of life. They didn't change l'ragle chamas hamitzik because of the suffering. That was his greatness. The Bayana Rebbe's greatness was that despite all of the hardships, he stayed true to his spiritual self. He was a charitable person before the war, and he was a charitable person during the war. He looked out for other people before and during. That is spiritual heroism. That's spiritual resistance. That's the parentheses. He says that's how great he was. So he gives you a little update then. You see the next section from another colleague of theirs, Rabbi Baumel, and then he gives you the list of deportees in lines 35 through 40. And now he comes to where we started today. Okay, this was a very long preamble, but this is very important. We started by talking about how life is complex and emunah is complex. I cannot imagine a more complex scenario than being the last living rabbi in the Judenrat in a ghetto in Lublin in October of 1942. So he writes, and you see where I put it on the side, he writes a question. Let's go to line 41. He says, after all the lists, he describes the deportees, the people who were killed, suffering, starving. He says, Meitav haklal kulo, the whole beauty in its entirety, shebechol hashteros pasak v'chadal milios, everything, the entire Jewish existence, it's over. Metropilios, meaning metropolis, the great cities. The Tel Talpios, Varsha Habira. What's that? Warsaw, the capital of Warsaw, I hear. Imkol Ad Morel, all the rabbinic leaders, the Hasidic masters, Verabonel, line 43. Sofrel, Orchel, Manigel, Shoftel, Kulam, Hol Hushvil of Netzar. They're all gone. And that is a paraphrase from a verse in a book. What book do you think he's paraphrasing from right now? Nope, not Megillah Esther. Worse than that. What's that? Maybe worse than Eov. Echa, Lamentations. That's a paraphrase pulled right out of Lamentations. Line 43. And now he pulls a little piece from the story of Yonah. What about the Kikayon of Yonah? My beloved friend, I don't know what to say about this. Haminoli, line 45. Believe me, Oev Naman Dovek Me'ach, my beloved friend, I love you like my brother. He writes to Rabbi Berglass. Shema'od ma'od kashe alai lahaflit varm ka'elu klape mala. It is difficult for me to say these things against God. I'm questioning God. I'm challenging God. How could this be? On the one hand, he said, Ani mamin, look at line 45 at the end of the underline, Hareini mamin be'emuna shlema, I believe with full faith, Sha'atzur tamim polo, that God is righteous. But I cannot accept the idea that all of us are guilty. That asher mabul shel dam ve'esh v'simros ashan. That's on line 47. Dom va'esh v'simro sashon. Where is that a paraphrase from? What's that? Yes, the Haggadah. He's saying we're suffering what is described. Dom va'esh v'simro sashon. How can we be that guilty? What model is he using here? He's using the model of schar va'onesh, reward and punishment. That this is happening to us because of things that we did. This is when I want to remind you about this volume, this important work called The Holy Fire. This is Professor Nehemiah Poland's work analyzing the transformation of the theological approach to the Holocaust from the Piasetzner Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto. The reason why this work, why the Piasetzner's teachings, and by this letter of Rabbi Talmud are so important and is singular, is because there are thousands and thousands of pages written about theological responses to the Holocaust. But how many were written contemporaneously by people who were experiencing it? So what's interesting is that Nehemiah Poland charts how at the beginning of the Eish Kodesh, of the Drashos, the sermons of the Piasetzner, he talks about Schar Va'onesh, reward and punishment, but how after several months, that theme disappears from the language of Rabbi Shapira. And he's no longer talking about Schar Va'onesh, and he's talking about transmuting evil and the sacrifice of Rabbi Akiva. Because he cannot use the categories, the traditional theological categories of reward and punishment to explain what he's seeing. This is what Reb Hirsch Talmud is writing in the letter. He's saying, I can't accept the categories of Schar Va'onesh with what I see in my eyes. So I'm living a contradiction. I believe in you, Rabbono Shel Olam. And yet I cannot accept that the explanation of Schar Va'onesh can fit what happens with my own eyes. And we've seen how this has happened. It's so painful. And how does he feel about this cognitive dissonance? Look at the long underline in line 50. Umeirov sichi v'tzari dibarti aveina. I'm writing out of a place of anguish. Ve'ein adam nitfas al tzaro. Because I'm suffering, I'm speaking out against God, so you shouldn't hold it against me. Because I'm suffering. I'm in pain. He says, what about my wife? What about my one son? He says, I have one son. He is botzim mikatfe. He is so sweet. He's such a nice boy. He's such a young man, a mensch, a Talmud Chacham, a Ben Torah. And he's murdered. Can you explain that? He says. He says, I'm living with this contradiction. He has this crisis. On the one hand, he has a moon. On the other hand, he's seeing the most horrible things. And you see in the next section where I wrote here, situational awareness, because he knows exactly what's going on. That's part of what's so crazy here. In this next section, he says, I know that there are rivavos, tens of thousands, and millioni achinu b'nei Yisrael, I'm on line 53, that are in this matzav, but they don't know. Line 54, they think, what do they think? Do you remember what do the people think when they're told they're being deported? That's it, they're going to the east. That's what he knows. This is written at this time, and he's saying, this is still October 4, 1942. Rabbi Talmud is saying, I know that there are tens of thousands of Jews who are being resettled, but they're not being resettled anywhere. You know that we're going to be resettled. They're getting resettled to gas chambers. So he says, I'm no better than all of them, but we're all in the same boat. Aval onu po kvar ra'inu, he says, look at 555. We know. V'yodim ana nishlachim. We know where they are being sent. Umumasim elu milyone Yisrael, line 57. They are going to be killed, these millions of Jews. Uvechol rega v'chol shah. Every moment, Ovrim lefanenu kibenei maron. They are passing before us kibenei maron. Where does the expression, another rabbinic expression, over the fun of kibenei maron, where does that appear? Where? Yes! Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So he's invoking the image of the scrutiny before God from the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah over the fun of kibenei maron. The Gemara says it's like sheep or like one at a time. Like the Chayos Beis David, that's what he's invoking. So he says, I'm living and I hear trains. The trains pass by, Kibbenei Maron, these transport, he calls them transportim. Shleimim im anoshim noshim v'taf, men, women, and children. He says, what's going to happen? He tells you, he's writing this. He's writing this to his friend on 58. He says, the healthy ones are going to go to labor and the other ones, they're going to go straight to horrible death.
Yeah. Why is he writing this letter just as information?
So it's interesting. It's a good question why he's writing this in the letter. He might be writing it informationally. At the end, you will see the end of the letter. I'll skip to the end for a second. That he describes at the end of the letter how there's some catharsis. To be able to talk to a friend. To be able to unburden himself. Because you imagine, you're the rabbi. Who are you going to talk to? Who can you pour out your heart to? Who are your friends? You go back to your friends from yeshiva days, to this chaver of Ayrley Berglas, who he says is mamish like his best friend. So, A, it sounds like he's keeping you up to speed on what's going on. But also, you'll see at the end, he's like, I think he feels a sense of catharsis.
You know, I find it amazing that the Nazis would allow him to write this letter.
So I don't know if they saw this letter. I suspect that this letter... I don't know. Maybe he sent it through a messenger. Could be. I don't know. I doubt. I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know if they saw this. I doubt that they did. Doesn't seem like that. Yeah, like could be. That's interesting. It could be. That's interesting. I don't know.
Although it's also past the Great Deportation.
Yes, so by that time in Warsaw, it's going to be mostly late anyway. Yeah, but that is interesting. Maybe it is a warning. I think, if I'm not mistaken, many of the Jews from Lublin, like you said, they think they were taken to Belzec earlier. Belzec was, I think, the first stop for most of them.
Yeah, they were...
Right. So the notion of... seeing someone write contemporaneously with that level of situational awareness, I'm not a Holocaust scholar, so I don't know how many other documents there are like this at this time, but this is exceptional. So you're talking about a situational awareness with a crisis of faith and going back and forth. And he talks about how this is happening. You would say, okay, maybe it happened to one person. You go now, you mentioned Megillas Esther before. You ready for another reference? Now this time it's a reference to Megillas Esther. Go down to line 61. At the end of that is mi ba'mai, mi ba'ish, mi ba'chanika, mi ba'skila. You see the end of that bracket, which is obviously lifted straight from the liturgy of Nisan HaTokef. Exactly. So that's an Nisan HaTokef reference, how people are going to die. Ve'im b'yechidim, if it was just a few people, haya hadavar nemar hecherashti, I would be silent. Where's that a reference to? That's right, Esther. He says, but it's not. It's everyone. They're killing everyone. The entire Jewish people. How can you be silent? How can I cry out? So he challenges. They're given to, he's crying out. And not only that, he struggles with hope. Go down to line 67 at the end. My Havi Alon, what's going to happen to us? Ma Tahavi Alon, what will be with us? Ana Nolich Eschar Paseinu, where will we take our disaster, our shame? Loma Yomer Agoyim Ayino Eloheim, why will the Gentiles say, where's their God? Where is their God? Esvada begoyim le'inenu. Nikmas dam avadecha shafach. I want to see the revenge. Where is this going to happen? Yakum Moshia Israel. He's calling out. He's saying, there's got to be a salvation. Where's the salvation? Kiyim lo achshav.
Where's their God?
Yes, exactly. It's the mockery. It's from Tehillim and it's from Avarachmim. Achshav, im lo achshav emasai. Line 70. If not now, when's going to happen? And he's worried. Hein kulanu, go to 71. Ve'ein af nitzotz, line 72, shel tikvali natzel. There's not even a spark of hope to be saved. He says, we don't even see a spark. There's no hope. Now he writes something amazing. Why does he write this letter? So, I don't know about the particular detail that you asked about before, but you know why he wants to write this letter? He says, why am I writing this down? Amazing. And?
Remember him.
Yes. Could you imagine?
It's so far, I don't want to say, their rarity is so far-fetched.
But guess what? It happened. If this, these letters would not have been found, you know, how many? It's painful to think. I'm mamish like, it's hard to even say. How many hundreds of rabbis? I'm a rabbi. I learned in a yeshiva. You know, I work in a community. How many hundreds of rabbis who worked in communities who gave their lives for their congregants were murdered and no one knows their name? No one heard of them? It's a heartbreak. It's mamish a heartbreak. So what does he say? He says, part of the reason why I wrote this letter is so that at least I shouldn't be forgotten. That nobody should say we didn't exist. Go down to the bottom. This is what I'm going to ask. Line 73, Baha Mechisna, with this I'll end, Baha Salikna, with this I'll go away. I'm sorry we're going so overtime today. I'm going to write to somebody. Kamat Shavahuli. It's worth it to me to write a letter to anyone. Im Yadanu Lekav Schusim Lo, even if they're going to judge me favorably or not. Because what I'm writing here says Rabbi Talmud, I know it's controversial. I know you can criticize me. But I want to write it any place. Hayisi al kaponim ach achas. There should be one person should yishar al kaponim zecher meitanu, that somebody should remember us. Ki hafzenu lahoel haklal. Remember us in the future that we tried to help other people. Remember us that we tried to do magamasinu oisal asakim piritzus ador to help the generation, to help people. Remember us. Lahafich. Ruach Chaim Chadashim Bikerbenu, to give people life. Otherwise, no one's going to remember what we did. Chafetz Hayinu, line 76, Sheyishar Zichron Kolshu. We would like that there should be just some memory. Well, maybe when we're sitting this afternoon learning this letter from Reb Hirsch Melech Talmud, his neshama is looking down from heaven and he's saying, ah, you see, there's a kid in Skokie, Illinois, who's learning with Choshva people, and we're remembering his neshama. Mi Shemi, from my father, my name, V'shem Avosai, my parents, Mi Bini Yechidi, Asher Avas Olam Ahavti, my one son who I loved so much. Can you remember my son? Can you remember my parents? Maybe, last long line, Sha'al Kolponim Michtavize, my letter, this letter, the last line of the page, Yishar Lezecher Olam, Ubeze Hayisi Misnachim, and with this I would be comforted. I would be comforted in knowing that my letter will remain. Avogam Zelo Nitan Lonu. How does he end the page? But that's not given to us either, because they're not going to remember us. Even the letter is going to be destroyed. Go to the top of the next page. And he describes his crying and the challenge of hope. He said in line 85, Nisisi lehisnachim biyude hanavim. I'm a rabbi. I tried to comfort myself with the words of the prophets. And I got kibalti kartis, line 87, Beosios Latinios, in English letters, from Reb Shimon of Zelichov. And it tried to give me encouragement, but you know what? It didn't help. It didn't help. I'm struggling for comfort. It still hurts. He says, we look around, line 92, there is destruction everywhere. Hapachar umogar misaviv kashim minaso. The fear, it's crippling. Gam anachnu mefachadim. We're also in trepidation. Umisyarim. And we are afraid. Afshek far menuka amakom biyud gimel nafos. That is a rabbinic reference to when they would sift the flour for an offering, a korban. The Mishnah says in Menachos they would use 13 sieves. So he says, you might think we're going to be safe because we've already survived all of the deportations. We've been sifted through. He says, doesn't help. Ze ayom shamati. I heard today, Shabbamunusino Rabim, because of us, that when it comes time, it's not, this doesn't mean we're safe. Bechol, it's everywhere. And then what does he say? Let's conclude the letter. 96. Va'ato diacha. Okay, now that I told you about that, let me tell you about Yontif. How was Yontif? Ah, chagim avru aleinu be'ezus Hashem b'menucha. We had a quiet Yontif. Hispalalnu b'mekomos acharim. We davened in a few places. Line 96. Va'af hakitzonim shebamachane shemeolam lo hirichu reach tefila b'tzibur. You know, even the people in the community, they never came to shul before. They never even smelled a scent of a synagogue. Guess what? Shaktu bo kulam, the Beis HaTfila, they all came to shul. They all came to shul on Yantif. Lo lahaskaras manishamas bovad, not just for Yizkor. This letter, we could really spend like 6 months and deconstruct each element here, because these are each their own, in their own right, incredible windows into the spiritual experience that's going on here. So this is a whole nother layer of describing the non-religious people who are coming to shul in the Lubliner ghetto for Yontif 1942. How unbelievable. Kemo kein haya lanu, we had an esrog and dalad minim. And he thinks, he says, I think we are one of the few in the whole country who had the four species on Sukkot in the Lubliner ghetto. So now he concludes, Va'ata mo Hashem shol me'imanu. And now, line 99, what is God asking for us? Havo nekave, let us hope. He comes back to it. Ki harisha kula ka'ashen tichla. That is a paraphrase from Rosh Hashanah davening, that the evil and the wicked will be destroyed. V'tochel shanas gu'ul alonu l'kol, we will have a year of redemption. Line 101. For all the Jewish people. A prayer for hope. Va'ata, now go to line 102. He sends the letter. Yedidi ayakar, my beloved friend. Kasafti l'cha ba'arichas. I wrote you a long letter. Kimedumali, it seems to me, shenasa nekal al levavi, that it's a little easier on my heart. Be'es eshpoch sichi, when I could pour out my heart, there's a catharsis. Doneni efo lekafskus, he says in the underline. Please judge me favorably when you read my writings, when you read about my questions. Va'al tishifein tisimeni lemetaptet umedaber dvarim. And don't just push me away as somebody who's frittering with words. Ksov gamata michtav aroch. You too, please write me a long letter. These are two friends. Write me a long letter. Umefurat mikol ma'asecha. Write all about the things that you did. Ubiikar, and the main thing, mimatzav hakloli, from the general situation, shel ircha, of your city, usvivosecha, on your neighborhood. Yema magefa netzara. Maybe the plague is over where you are. Vegam yesh lecha ezi yedios. If you have any news, mimi mechavireinu umakireinu ushar pratim. What about the rest of our friends? Our guys from yeshiva, the boys we learned with, the rabbis we knew. He wishes him with life that's blessed. Chayei baruch v'chayei betov shalcha ha'neman b'chol lev. Yours with all heart.
Forgive me, Rabbi. I have a heartbeat.
Yes, it's not a handwritten letter. It's done with a typewriter. And what's interesting is that if you look, I can send you in the Lubliner archives, in those archives where the calendar was, there's also an edition that's typeset. So the calendar, he evidently wrote it, and he also typed it. We have two different versions. But let me just wrap it up, and then we'll close the question. So if we go back to where we started, right, this is about looking at the Holocaust through a specific set of eyes. This is a very unique set of eyes. The eyes of a man who was raised in Lublin intellectually, who was a student in the yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin, who became a rabbi, who was the last remaining rabbi, or of the last remaining rabbis, I can't say authoritatively that there were no other rabbis at all, but how he sees the theological crisis within the context of his situational awareness, and how he's maybe more aware than almost any other Jew in Poland of what's actually happening, and at the same time is sticking to his emuna and open with his friend about how difficult that is and what a struggle it is and how many questions there are and that they aren't answered. And that the life is complicated, the situation is complicated, and emuna is complicated. But that openness, that frankness, that candor, that humanity that comes through in this letter, it speaks to really just an unbelievable human and spiritual greatness. And so we really could deconstruct each piece of this letter from a different vantage point, but I think maybe the overarching theme is the struggle of dealing with, of facing evil head on, and at the same time being a person of such deep faith that even with the questions, we always come back to God at the end of the story. And so this letter can be a great source of strength for people who are struggling to imagine. Nobody could even imagine what this situation is like. So to take one piece of that, to hold on to his coattails, that can carry us forward. I will just also thank, I have to note, to thank Professor Zilberklang, because it was with his permission that I'm sharing this letter with you today.